This is Dean Kate Moorhead Carroll in the podcast Find It. And today I have with me a professor of anthropology, Keith Ashley, from the University of Northern Florida. He taught a class here at the Cathedral on the history of Florida, particularly the indigenous history. And it was so good that I needed to do a podcast with him. So welcome, Keith. Tell me a little bit about how you got interested in anthropology.
Okay. Well, thank you for inviting me. Well, I went away to school to Auburn, and I went there to be an engineer. So my first 2 years were in pre-engineering, where you kind of set the stage for what kind of engineering you want to go into. And I was in my last class in pre-engineering, and it was a statics class, a physics of fixed objects. And I just had this kind of epiphany that, you know, is this what I want to do with the rest of my life? And I wanted to have something where I really had passion for it. Well, engineering is a great field. It just wasn't really my
calling. Yeah.
So I decided to transfer into something that I really had always liked, and that was archaeology, particularly Native Americans. And what was really great about my parents were just really supportive
doing
that.
Yeah. So, but what was it about Native Americans that grabbed you?
I think just growing up, I'd always really had an interest in the past, and the Native Americans and the kind of the plight of Native Americans was a concern, and so I really wanted to learn more about Native Americans. I thought there were a lot of myths and things out there that weren't really true, so I wanted to be kind of in a field where we could learn more about their way of life.
And it really is a burgeoning field, isn't it? It's amazing to me. When you taught our class, you talked about how much of us in this country, our history sort of begins when the colonialists arrived.
Yeah.
And you opened my mind to the fact that there were thousands of years of history of this country with the people living here.
Yeah.
And why is that we don't think about that? Why do we begin our history when white people arrive?
Probably because most of us are kind of white ancestry, so we don't have that deep long-term connection to the continent. You know, it begins when our relatives arrived, our ancestors arrived. But like Jacksonville, think about the human history of Jacksonville. 97% of that human history is an indigenous history.
Wow.
It's just the last 3% that Europeans have arrived, and we have American culture and so forth. So it's a small part of it.
Wow.
But it gets 99% of
it. It gets so much
spotlight.
Attention. It was like everything was darkness before we arrived. We're so full of hubris. It's incredible. So tell me a little bit. This is a huge swath of human history then that you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
How long have people lived on this continent as far as we know?
On the continent, I think it's undergoing challenges right now, but I would say the general consensus is probably 15, 18,000 years ago.
Wow.
Some would push it back a little bit into the early 20s. But it's been a while. I think the earliest dates that we have in secure context within the state of Florida is 14,500 years ago from a sinkhole in the Scylla River in the panhandle part of Florida. And it's on mastodon remains that are in association with human-made artifacts.
Okay, tell me a little bit more. So you're saying 15 to 18,000 years ago, we think we found some artifacts. What is it exactly that we found? We said mastodon.
Is like a megafaun. It's like a large elephant of the day.
Oh, wow. So, we found a large elephant in
Florida? Yeah, so there are megafauna, which are the Ice Age animals that were here.
Wow.
So those remains have been found throughout Florida.
Oh, cool.
But we do find it near the tail end where they're actually in association with humans as well. So we start to see mastodons and mammoths. And then the larger bison, not the bison that we're familiar with, but the Ice Age bison, which was a little bit larger. So we have those remains in a couple of contexts within Florida, not in Jackson, but in Florida. We have like skulls with projectile points, stone points embedded in the skull, showing that they were impaled with a spear. So that's kind of direct evidence. We have other mastodon bones that have cut marks and butcher marks, and they're found in association with stone tools, or the debris of stone tools. So
amazing.
We have really good what we call associations with them.
And what would happen in a sinkhole that would preserve these things?
Well, what's funny is a lot of these were not sinkholes at the time. They would have been low ponded areas. So they were probably along the edge of those ponded areas as the sea level was rising. So like the Scylla River was probably a series of sinkholes. But as the ice melted and it warmed, that basically increased the ocean waters, which then put pressure on the groundwater and pushed it up. So the rising sea levels meant the interior water table was rising. So what had been dry areas now become wet areas and then become rivers. So sometimes people go tubing in the Itchituckee and they've found projectile points or stone artifacts. Mm. People like to call them arrowheads, but most of them aren't arrowheads, at the bottom of the river. So they think they were thrown into the river, when in reality they were dropped on the ground and then water subsequently
lifted them up.
Yeah.
Wow.
Or covered them up with water.
I see. Covered them with water. Yeah. Gotcha.
So wow. So if we think about it, 14,000 years ago when the first humans are kind of moving into Florida, this is at the tail end of the Ice Age, so it's much cooler. Mm-hmm. So the state of Florida is probably a little more than twice its width that we have now.
Oh my goodness.
So right now, if we projected ourselves back 14,000 years ago and we're standing on the beach, mm-hmm. and our toes are in the water, and then we could like transform ourselves back 14,000 years, that water would be 90 miles away from us.
Amazing.
So a lot of the occupations during that time were probably farther out, mm-hmm. under the waters now. Mm-hmm. And I think the only couple of artifacts that we have that date to this period in Jacksonville area are actually from the beach. So they were washed in from further out on shore when that was dry land.
Fascinating. So what were people doing 14, 15,000 years ago? What kind of life did they live?
So they were probably moving around quite a bit.
Okay.
They were, you know, going after seasonally available animals, water, all those types of things. And there would have been the larger Ice Age mammals at the time, so the mastodons and mammoth, the larger bison, some of the really large tortoises, which have been kind of like the size or bigger than the Galapagos Island turtles, so really large ones. Mm-hmm. So they would have gone after those, plus animals that are more comparable in size to what we have today. And so they would have been moving throughout the area, going to water sources. Water would have been a lot more scarce than it is right now. The Everglades wouldn't have existed. St. John's River didn't exist. So a lot of these places didn't exist. So they would seek out areas where there were basins that could capture rain when it happened, or where there were springs or other kind of outlets to enable them to get to some of the deeper areas of water.
And do we know, eventually we get to identify different indigenous tribes, and what time can we identify different tribes as behaving differently from one another?
So we start to see probably, so the glaciers start to melt and sea level begins to rise, and it's rising and it's rising. It probably starts to stabilize somewhat about 4,000 to 5,000 years ago.
Okay.
So at that point in time, we start to see the estuary form, which is kind of the mixture of the fresh water and the salt water,
mm-hmm.
and it creates these really rich estuarine environments. And so we start to see those in roughly the areas where what they are now. And at that point in time, which is about 5,000 years ago, we start to see them living full time in our area. Probably prior to that time, they're just kind of moving throughout mm-hmm. the area, mm-hmm. and just camping here for short periods of time. After that point in time, once the estuary forms, they start to become fishers, and they really are living in this area throughout the year. And so that's where we start to see that. And that's happening in other areas of the state, too. So we begin to start to see kind of some regional flair, some regional kind of identities emerging at that point in time. But the history is incredibly dynamic. People are moving into and out of areas. People are kind of merging together, splitting apart. Incredibly dynamic history. I think people really look back and think, their impression of indigenous people is probably from the 1560s. They read the French accounts or heard someone reading the French accounts and talking about the Tumuqua. So that's most people's idea of what the indigenous people were in this area. And they think that they were basically timeless, that they were always that way, that they never changed.
Right.
And that's not true at all. There mm-hmm. was an incredible change. Change was really the norm. It mm-hmm. didn't take Europeans arrive for them to change.
It's funny how we think of the past as being something static. We mm-hmm. always approach it in that way. Mm-hmm. But yet there was so much change and so much diversity of both physically and the people changed.
Yeah, I think when they start thinking of indigenous people kind of frozen in time or static, that you don't assign them any history. They have no history, when in reality they have this great history.
Right.
And that's what we try to bring out through archaeology.
Wow, that's amazing. And do we get, is there a place in time when we begin to see a kind of spirituality developing? I'm sure there always was.
I think there always was. It's just sometimes hard. Some of the earliest people that are moving into this area, they don't have pottery that isn't made at the time. So there aren't a lot of material things that preserve. So mm-hmm. it's hard for us to really get at those things. But looking at broader indigenous kind of ontologies and philosophies and religion, you know, there's a lot of animism. There's a belief in the spiritual forces throughout nature and throughout the world. So those things are probably with them early on.
Mm-hmm.
Usually when we start seeing things that may be of a more potentially concrete look towards religion is when we start seeing them kind of haven't believed in an afterlife and through burials and things along those lines.
I see.
But that's becoming kind of an area that we don't really deal with anymore, because we don't want to disturb indigenous remains if indigenous people today don't want us to. So I think it's really important that in the past we used to dig up Indian mounds and dig up Indian grave goods without really consulting them. Mm-hmm. And I think now we're trying to develop that relationship with
that
them.
Respect. Yeah. Our desire for knowledge is not more important than their heritage.
And to kind of honor what it is they want us to do.
Yeah. Wow. You know, it's really fascinating that we're beginning to wake up to the forces of nature and the value of nature and the personalities of animals in a way, maybe because we are becoming aware of the fact that we're not treating the earth as we should. And as we wake up to these things, we begin to look back at Native spirituality and the fact that they respected and saw kind of spirits of mountains or rivers, and in effect these entities do have a power to them. They're not God for us, but they certainly have an animism that we haven't respected for a long time, don't they?
Yeah, and we don't really understand, like, the groups that are in our area. We don't have anyone in the 1500s who wrote it down, so we really don't know what it specifically is. But if we can kind of borrow broadly from the southeastern Indians in general, the Cherokee and the Creeks and others, where we have information today as well from the 1600s and later, there seems to be this broad acceptance among indigenous people that there were three worlds, that there was this world, the upper world, and the underworld. Mm-hmm. But these shouldn't be seen as like heaven and hell. They're really kind of different. The upper world is perfection. So all animals are in perfect forms. Mm-hmm. It's expectedness. It's predictability. It's future time. The underworld is the opposite. It's all chaos and everything. The upper world and underworld both have spirits and forces, and both the spirits and forces can be good and can be bad in both areas. And then we have the middle world is the world that we live in, and that's the world of balance between the two. And so a lot of their spirituality and a lot of their kind of religion is about harmony and creating balance, you know, within the world. Mm-hmm. And they see the spirit realm and the kind of the physical realm as coexisting in the same time, in the same place, that they're not separated, that upper world has a dimension on earth, and they can see that imprinted on the landscape, and same thing with the underworld. Like sinkholes and other types of ponds are portals into the underworld.
Wow.
Birds can give flight to the above world. Mm-hmm. So they see all of this kind of happening. Present time and past time occur at the same time, so there's circularity to this. So it's really different than Western way of thinking about things.
Yeah, so their idea of time is really circular then.
Correct.
Oh, that's really interesting.
So the present can exist, and the past can exist in the present.
Mm.
And having artifacts or things from the deep past is kind of a physical manifestation of that. And they believe that things that we see as inanimate can become alive in certain contexts, or with certain prayers, or in certain bundling them with certain things can bring them to life and bring that past to the present.
And it's interesting because quantum mechanics is now telling us that even an inanimate object is full of moving things, you know,
right,
that are, in a way that everything is very much alive and in motion. Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah. So as we think of the Timucua tribe as being around here, but they're not really, are they still here in terms of, are there descendants there, our descendants here? What has happened to that tribe in particular?
So I think most people, when they think of this area in terms of indigenous people, they think of the Timucua.
Timucua.
We don't know how to pronounce it. Oh, everyone has a different version, so really mine is not correct.
Okay.
But Timucua, any term that we use for them, we're kind of imposing on them. We don't know what their self-identifying name was.
Oh.
So we use this. So their Timucua is actually a language. So Timucua was an indigenous language spoken kind of in northern peninsula Florida and into southeastern Georgia. And we know within that language, there were dialects of that language. So there was a dialect called Mocama. And Mocama is actually an indigenous word that means the sea, S-E-A. Mm. So the groups that are here from roughly just south of the mouth of the St. John's River into southeastern Georgia spoke the Maritime or Mocama dialect.
Okay.
So sometimes we'll refer to them as Mocama, but Timucua. So these are terms that we use for the 15th and 16th and 17th century, because we know they're in the documents. It's kind of hard sometimes to take those terms and apply them to deep time because people are moving in and out, indigenous mm-hmm. people are moving in and out of the area.
They were just so transient that
So for the Tumukwa, we know most people have this terminal narrative, oh, they're extinct, they're no longer here anymore. In a way, that's not true. As a distinct cultural entity, the Tumukwa no longer exists. But we know from Spanish documents that Tumukwa were constantly leaving the area, moving out, as they put it, into the woods. Uh-huh. And as they're moving out to the woods, they're probably kind of melding in with other groups.
Yeah.
And so they're eventually, they do have heritage today and connections today with the Seminoles of Florida, mm. also with the Muscogee of Oklahoma.
Okay.
Some Mocama were known to have gone to the Apalachee region, which is Tallahassee. Mm-hmm. And then from there, they moved into the Lower Creek area of Alabama. Mm-hmm. Then eventually they get moved through the Trail of Tears, you know, to Oklahoma. So we see both those groups of the Seminole and the Muscogee claiming Northeast Florida's ancestral homelands.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there is a connection. So we don't have Tumukwa as an entity today, but their bloodline still exists. It's just a little bit harder dots to connect. It's not as straight lined.
I see.
So I think sometimes it's a misnomer to say that there were no longer any Tumukwa.
Mm-hmm.
They're just within other cultures, indigenous cultures.
Well, as people who try, we try in this church to follow Jesus, and we're waking up to the fact that we've, you know, annihilated other peoples and cultures, or tried to. Let's say they're not gone, but they certainly have been diminished.
Yes.
What is your advice for us in terms of reconciling to our past, understanding it, and how can we honor the peoples that have come before us?
I think it's through good relationships with them today. Because indigenous people still exist, you know, today. We have, you know, 573 federally recognized indigenous communities throughout nations, throughout the United States.
Mm.
So they're here today, and I think that we can acknowledge them as existing today, seek their advice on things, and recognize them in their past. So I think that's really, really important. So as an archaeologist, I think that's one thing we're really trying to do now, is to basically be more collaborative with them, a partnership with mm-hmm. them when we study the past. We are, in the past, I think sometimes archaeologists or historians kind of claim to be the sole authority on indigenous past, and mm-hmm. that is not, I mean, that was hubris on our
part.
They
have their own verbal history.
And so sometimes we may disagree in how we interpret it, but mm-hmm. I think as long as we respect one another, I think there's a great middle ground for us to learn from each other. So I think that's the thing, is for us, is to invite them to be part of the process.
Mm. And knowing the self is part of knowing God, and knowing ourselves as people who have made a lot of mistakes, as someone who's white and came over, my ancestry's pretty much from England. So to know yourself and to try to correct or redirect yourself and learn about the others who have lived here far before us. A lot of people call them now First Nations people, which sounds respectful. Do you like that word?
Yeah, the First Nations, that was big, and it started really in Canada, and then they've moved down into our area as well. So yeah, Indigenous, First Nation, First People.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think to me, what's really important is not trying to be politically correct, but if you interact with them, what do you want to be called? What do you prefer?
Yeah, that's good, Keith.
And I think a lot of Indigenous people today used to, in the 70s, they were trying to gain strength in numbers so they would accept one term for us all, whether it be Indians or Native American. I think today they still recognize that connection, but they want to say, hey, we're a little different than this indigenous group. Mm-hmm. We are the Dene. We are the Seminoles. We're Native American. We love that, but we have our own history and our own customs too that are mm-hmm. just important. So we want you to learn about those. So I think, mm-hmm. to me, it's all about respect. And for me personally, I just think we need to acknowledge our past mistakes, not to sweep them under the rug like they didn't happen.
Right.
And just try to...
Well, I mean, in the Christian tradition, that's what confession is all about. You're supposed to tell what you did wrong and what your ancestors did as well, and then bring it out into the light and look at it. And that's how you move forward and forgive and move on, is not by ignoring it.
Right.
It's by looking at it.
Yeah.
So, well, I'm really grateful for the work that you're doing, Keith, and it's great to have you right around here.
Yeah.
Thank you for expanding my understanding of history.
Well, thanks for having me.
And God bless you all who are listening. I hope you have a wonderful week.